Shalom, and welcome to the Hebraic Heritage Ministries Yeshiva Discipleship Program. We are giving a teaching on Hebraic Bible prophecy and how the creation of a PLO state will lead to the judgment of the nations and the ingathering of the exiles. The events that surround the tribulation, which is called Jacob's trouble, is an end-time battle between the house of Esau and the house of Jacob that draws the entire world into the conflict. The Bible also calls this conflict the controversy of Zion. In the first two sessions, we laid a foundation for you so that any believer in Yeshua as the Messiah will be able to begin and realize that the prophecies of the tribulation period, of which the main purpose of the tribulation is for Messiah to be glorified through the ingathering of the exiles, or the end of the exile of the house of Jacob, in order so that those that believe that Yeshua is the Messiah will realize and understand that these prophecies relate and pertain to them. We had our first two sessions to first clarify that Yeshua died on the tree to gather the exiles of Israel, as we're told in John chapter 10. Verses 16 and 17, and is repeated in John chapter 11, verses 49 through 52. The second session was about understanding the name of the family of Yeshua the Messiah, who is the house of Jacob. Because Yeshua created the heavens and the earth, he is the one that redeemed his people from Egypt. He is the giver of the Torah at Mount Sinai. He made the covenant with Abraham. In making the covenant with Abraham and in giving the Torah at Mount Sinai, Yeshua entered into covenant with the literal physical house of Jacob. They broke the covenant at Mount Sinai. Yeshua, through the prophets, is to gather the exiles of Israel. He does this by dying on the tree, laying down his life, paying the penalty for their sin, and through his shed blood and the house of Jacob asking for forgiveness of their sins, he redeems the house of Jacob. And in doing so, he offers redemption to all whosoevers on the earth, enabling them to be grafted into the renewed covenant made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In this session, we're going to begin by looking at the 7,000-year plan of Yahweh. This is important to understand to properly place the event of the tribulation in its right framework. In traditional Christianity, we have been taught to look at the end of days by separating the tribulation from the Messianic era. It's commonly taught that the Messianic era begins once Yeshua sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives. But by understanding the 7,000-year plan of Yahweh and how Paul taught in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, that the Sabbath teaches about the second coming of Yeshua the Messiah, we are going to learn by looking at the 7,000-year plan of Yahweh that the Messianic era begins with the tribulation. The Bible tells us that the tribulation or the darkness part of the day of Yahweh comes as a thief in the night. In order to recognize that we are in this period of time, the Bible gives us events which we are to watch for, because we're called to be watchmen. And when we see these events happening, that's going to allow us to understand what time we are in. Looking at the 7,000-year plan of Yahweh, Scripture establishes from the creation of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden to the end of the Messianic era is 7,000 years of time. In order to understand the end of days, we need to realize a very important biblical principle, and that is the God of Israel has shown us the end of days from the beginning of time. We can see this from Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 through 11, which says, "Remember the former things of old, for I am Elohim and there is none else. I am Elohim, there is none like me." The reason why there's none like him is the following: because he declared the end from the beginning. The word beginning is Reshit, from which we get the word Reshit or Genesis. He declared the end of days from the beginning, and from ancient times he declared the things that are not yet done, saying, "My counsel or my wisdom or my plan will stand, and I will do all my pleasure. I have spoken it, I will bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it." We can see this principle also in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9, and Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 15, as it is written, "The thing that has been," that's history, "is that which shall be," that is future, that's prophecy, "and that which is done," the things that are happening in the earth right now, "is that which shall be done, and there's nothing new under the sun." Ecclesiastes 3:15, it is written, "That which has been," that is history, "is now, and that which is to be," that is future, "has already been, and God requires that which is past." In order to understand how the end was told in the beginning, we need to realize that the 7 days of creation that is outlined in Genesis chapter 1 and 2 foreshadows 7,000 years of time, which is alluded to in Psalm chapter 90, verse 4, as it is written, "For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night." 1,000 years is associated to yesterday or one day. Peter picks up this thought in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, when he writes, "But beloved, be not ignorant." This is another area of Scripture where the body of Messiah is ignorant. Don't be ignorant that one day is with Yahweh 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Peter goes on to say in 2 Peter in chapter 3 and verse 10, "But the day of Yahweh." So if he begins by saying, don't be ignorant that one day is with Yahweh 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day, and then he says in verse 10, "But the day of Yahweh," how long then is the day of Yahweh? It would be 1,000 years. And it says in 2 Peter in chapter 3, verse 10, how the day of Yahweh comes. It says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, "But the day of Yahweh comes as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat." It comes as a thief, and it comes in the night, or darkness. We refer to this as the tribulation period. Now, Paul also wrote regarding the end of days that we are children of the day. and we're not children of the night, that these days should overtake us as a thief in the night. In referring to being children of the day, this is a reference to knowing and understanding Torah, because the Torah is likened unto light. So he says, those who know Torah, specifically, Paul made reference that those who know the times and the seasons. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. But of the times and the seed that I write to you, the times and the seasons is a reference to the Moed, the festivals, which the Sabbath is a festival. So concerning the Sabbath and the festivals, you have no need that I write to you, because by understanding the Sabbath and the festivals, you know that the day of Yahweh comes as a thief in the night. Because each day in creation had a evening and a morning, so therefore the day of Yahweh begins in evening or in darkness, and clearly that is taught beginning in the book of Genesis. For when they say peace and safety, this can also be rendered security. When they say peace and security, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. Therefore, we're told that in the day of Yahweh, a sign of being in the day of Yahweh is the words will be uttered, peace and security. We're going to look later on in this session how peace that's being negotiated between Israel and her Arab neighbors is based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. And UN Resolution 242, which was passed in November of 1967, following the June 6-day war of 1967, it says in there that this is a peace and security agreement, that Israel will withdraw from territories which she possessed from the 6-day war and will in return have safe and secure borders. Paul goes on to say in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 4, but brethren, you are not in darkness that day should overtake you as a thief, for you are children of the light and children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Children of the day are people that know and understand Torah. If you know and understand Torah and how the times and the seasons teach about the end of days, you will understand how the Sabbath and the biblical festivals teach about the second coming of the Messiah. You will understand how there's 7,000 years to time. You will understand that the Jacob's trouble comes from a conflict between Jacob and Esau that is foreshadowed in Genesis in chapter 32, when Jacob is told by the God of Israel to return back to the land of his fathers, and there he has a confrontation with Esau. And you will understand that it is during Jacob's trouble that the exiles of Israel will be gathered back to the land of Israel. The way in which we understand these things is having a knowledge and an understanding of Torah and the festivals of the Torah. However, those who do not know, understand, or identify with Torah, they're walking in darkness. And it says that we are not called to walk in that darkness, but we're children of light. And it says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 6, therefore, let us not sleep as others, but let us watch and be sober. We're called to watch, which means we're called to be a watchman, which means we're called to know of the times and the seasons and watch for the events that are to take place. This tells us that others will be caught off guard from these events, but we are not to sleep, which means if we're not to sleep, it's possible to sleep. Those who are going to be sleeping are those who don't have a knowledge of Torah and that the end is told in the beginning. Looking at how there's 7,000 years to time, there's 4,000 years from Adam to Yeshua. And by looking at the genealogies given, beginning with Adam and taking it to the time of Abraham, the Torah tells us that there's 1,948 years from Adam to Abraham. I find this interesting because in our Gregorian calendar, the state of Israel was born in 1948. Then, taking from Abraham, then going to Isaac and Jacob, then the Exodus, we have 290 years. And then from the time in Egypt to the Exodus, and actually when we go from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, we're counting the time until from Abraham until the going down into Egypt, which is 290 years. And then from the going down into Egypt to the coming out of Egypt through Moses, which we call the Exodus, we count that period of time, and then we take the time in the wilderness to the death of Joshua, and then we count the period of the judges as found in the book of Judges. From there, we look at the kings of Judah. By looking at the time period of the judges, we have 450 years, and that time frame is also given to us in Acts chapter 13, verse 20. Then looking at the kings of Judah, beginning with King Saul, we have there going to the last king of Judah, who is Zedekiah, in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 11. We have 513 years under the kings of Judah. Judah was taken into Babylonian captivity in 586 BCE, before the Common Era. And if we calculate the time frame from Adam to and including the year of the Babylonian captivity, 586, which will bring us to the first century, and the birth of Yeshua, we can calculate that there is around 4,000 years from Adam to Yeshua. This is alluded to in the first verse of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, which in Hebrew reads, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. In the Hebrew, Hebrew is read from right to left. The fourth word of Genesis 1:1 is et, or aleph and tav. This is not translated into English because the aleph and the tav tells us what the direct object is in this sentence. And so if you're looking at it from a purely grammatical viewpoint, it doesn't get translated, but it's an allusion to Yeshua the Messiah, who is the Aleph and the Tav, the first and the last. And this appears as the fourth word in Genesis 1:1, alluding to Yeshua coming after 4,000 years of time. Revelation chapter 1, verse 5 speaks about Yeshua, and he's the first begotten of the dead, and upon him that loved us, and he washed us from our sins in his own blood. Goes on to say about him, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, or you would render it in Hebrew, I'm the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending, says Yahweh, which was, and which is to come. So the Aleph and the Tav is Yahweh, who is, which was, which is to come. He's also the Almighty, or El Shaddai. The Sabbath is the seventh day of creation. Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, we are told that Yahweh rested on the seventh day of creation. This is a prophetic allusion to the rest of the thousand-year messianic era. That day, called the Day of Yahweh, or the Day of Messiah, the day that He will rule and reign on the earth and bring peace to the world. The seventh-day Sabbath of creation foreshadows the messianic era. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8 talks about one day is likened to a thousand years, and a thousand years is one day, quoting from Psalm chapter 90, verse 4. Then it says in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, but the day of Yahweh will come as a thief in the night. Therefore, the day of Yahweh, the messianic era, begins in darkness or in tribulation. The Sabbath is the seventh day, Exodus chapter 20, verses 9 and 10. The seventh-day Sabbath is called the Day of Yahweh, Isaiah chapter 58, verse 13. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath and from doing your pleasure on my holy day, the Sabbath is called my holy day and called the Sabbath of delight, the holy of Yahweh honorable. The Sabbath is my holy day, or the Sabbath is the holy of Yahweh, or the Sabbath is the day of Yahweh. Now let's look at events that take place in the day of Yahweh, or the darkness part of the day of Yahweh, commonly called the tribulation, which is the beginning of the messianic era. To begin with, we're going to see how the day of Yahweh comes as a time of darkness. Isaiah 13, verse 6, for the day of Yahweh is at hand, it will come as destruction from the Almighty. Pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. Pangs and sorrows is a reference to the tribulation. Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. The great day of Yahweh is near, and it says the mighty man will cry there bitterly. That day, that is the day of Yahweh, is a time of wrath, trouble, distress, desolation, darkness, and gloominess. We have, during the day of Yahweh, is when we have Jacob's trouble. Jacob's trouble is a part of the day of Yahweh. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 6 talks about a time of travail, and it says in Jeremiah 30, verse 7, that day is great. What day? The day of Yahweh. There's none like it. It's the time of Jacob's trouble. Next, we're going to look at events which the Bible tells us that happen in the day of Yahweh. When we see these events happen, we will know that we are in tribulation. Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15 speaks about the day of Yahweh. It says it's a time of wrath, trouble, distress. And it says in Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 4, that Gaza shall be forsaken. In August of 2005, right? In August of 2005, Jews were expelled from the Gaza. Interpreting Gaza being forsaken as Jews being removed from their homes, this scripture could be used as possible argument of why we might be in the day of Yahweh or in the tribulation period right now. If this is actually the case, then I would liken it to a woman who is just starting her pregnancy. She is 1 or 2 months pregnant. She knows that she's pregnant, but those around her can't visibly see it and recognize it unless they are in the know regarding it. So in order to affirm that we are in the tribulation, from my perspective, we need further evidence. And that further evidence that the Bible gives us is that the land of Israel gets divided, the city of Jerusalem gets divided, wherein the enemy, as we're told in Ezekiel 36, verses 1 and 2, who's defined as being Esau in Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 5, says that the mountains of Israel or the West Bank belongs to him. the people in our media who are saying that the West Bank belongs to them, they call themselves today the Palestinians. However, the Bible refers to them as being Esau. From my perspective then, when I see the fulfillment of this prophecy, when I see the creation of a PLO state in East Jerusalem as its capital, that will affirm to me that we are in the tribulation period. And this is a major event which I am looking for, in which this teaching is regarding, is looking for this event and knowing what it means. And ultimately what it means is the judgment of the nations in the fall of Babylon, which will inaugurate one world government and the ingathering of the exiles. In Joel chapter 1, verse 15, it speaks about the day of the Lord being at hand. And in the day of the Lord, it says in Joel chapter 3, verse 2, He will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with the nations for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they've scattered among the nations and parted or divided my land. So in addition to the Gaza being forsaken, we're going to see a greater dividing of the land of Israel in the day of Yahweh. Zechariah chapter 14, verse 1 speaks about the day of Yahweh. And in the day of Yahweh, Zechariah 14, verse 2, it says that all nations will be gathered against Jerusalem to battle, and half of the city will go into captivity. Sometimes I hear people say, but Jerusalem is already divided today, and that is true. Today, Jerusalem is divided up into four quarters. But I'm talking about a dividing of the city of Jerusalem in the day of Yahweh, where half the city will go into captivity. Captivity is the biblical term for exile, or being removed from where you are staying or where you are living. So in the day of Yahweh, half the city will be exiled, and it's speaking about Jews who live in the city of Jerusalem. And I believe that this will prophetically come about when East Jerusalem becomes the capital of a PLO state, and the PLO will say no Jews are permitted to live in East Jerusalem, and will forcibly, and Jews in the city will forcibly be removed. It is when I see this event, to me, will make it clear that we are in the tribulation. As of now, this event has not yet happened. In Zechariah 14, verse 3, we see the consequence of when we see a PLO state with East Jerusalem as its capital. It says, Yahweh will go forth and fight against the nations as he fought in the day of battle. And the next verse says, and in that day his feet will set upon the Mount of Olives. So Yahweh here that's fighting against the nations is Yeshua the Messiah. And he will fight against the nations for Zion, as in the day of battle. When is the day of battle? The day of battle historically was when Pharaoh and his army drowned in the sea in Exodus chapter 15. He will fight against the nations as in that day. But how is he going to do it in the end of days? How will that fighting against the nations be manifested? It will be manifested through nuclear warfare. The judgment upon the nations for dividing Jerusalem, as we're told in Zechariah 14, verse 12, is that their flesh will melt away as they stand upon their feet. The day of the Lord, or the tribulation, is a time of the judgment of the nations for dividing the land of Israel. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7 talks about Jacob's trouble. And in the context of speaking about Jacob's trouble, it says in Jeremiah 30, verse 11, I am with you, says Yahweh, to save you, that is to gather the exiles of Israel, who is called Zion. Though I make a full end of all nations where I have scattered you, that is the judgment of the nations. In this teaching, I'm going to be focusing on the judgment that comes upon one nation, and that is codenamed Babylon in Scripture, who I believe spiritually is referring to the United States of America when we talk about the spiritual land of Babylon. However, it must be pointed out that Babylon is a generic term for everything associated with the kingdom of darkness that opposes Yahweh. So there is a physical land of Babylon, there is a financial Babylon, there is a religious Babylon, and I also believe there's a spiritual land of Babylon. In Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1, speaks about the burden of Babylon. Verse 6, it's the day of Yahweh. And in verse 19, it says, Babylon will be destroyed as Elohim overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And we know that happened by fire. The judgment of the nations is associated with the controversy of Zion, and another term for the time when Yeshua the Messiah judges the nations for dividing the land of Israel. It's called the Day of Yahweh's Vengeance. Isaiah 34, verse 2, for the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations. That's the judgment of the nations. Isaiah 34, 8, for it is the day of Yahweh's vengeance for the controversy of Zion, and it's the year of recompenses. Recompenses means payback. In other words, there's going to be payback unto the nations for how they treated the exiles of Israel or Zion of the end of days. Zion will return to the land of Israel during Jacob's trouble. And speaking about Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, it goes on to say in verse 17, I will restore health unto you, and I will heal you of your wounds. The wound is the exile. Health is the end of the exile, because they called you an outcast, saying, this is Zion whom no man seeks after. Yeshua the Messiah will return once he gathers the exiles of Israel. Psalm 102, verse 16. When Yahweh will build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. Yeshua said in Matthew 24 that he will appear in his glory. You'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds in great glory. What is building up of Zion? Psalm 147, verse 2. Yahweh builds up Jerusalem. He gathers together the outcasts of Israel. The building up of Zion is gathering the outcasts of Israel. This happens during Jacob's trouble. The setting of Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, is Jeremiah 30, verse 3, which says that Israel and Judah will return to the land given to their forefathers, and they will possess it. Next, we need to realize, in understanding these end of days events, that the return of the exiles is accompanied by two things that cause them to return. A great outpouring of the Holy Spirit, the greatest outpouring of the Holy Spirit that there has ever been, even exceeding that of the first century, along with the hunters who hunt for the exiles of Israel. And Jeremiah chapter 16, verse 15 speaks about the gathering of the exiles of Israel. Jeremiah 16, verse 16 says, after fishermen are sent out to gather them, which I believe has been happening for the past 2,000 years, then Yahweh says he will send for many hunters. And who is regarded as being a hunter? Genesis 25, verse 27. Esau is a cunning hunter. This, then, is going to take us to our next subject, and that is the battle and the characteristics of the battle between Jacob and Esau. Given that Esau is the cunning hunter, it is Esau who is going to be used by the God of Israel to bring Jacob home. What are the characteristics of this end time battle between Jacob and Esau? Well, to begin with, we need to reiterate the principle that the end is told in the beginning, from Isaiah chapter 46 and verses 8 through 11, as well as Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9, Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 15. That being the case, we can then look at Genesis and we can see how this foreshadows the hunters of the end of days. To get another very important principle regarding the end of days and connecting this to the end time battle between Jacob and Esau, in Psalm 78, verses 1 and 2 and verse 4, we are told the following. Give ear, O my people, to my Torah. I will open my mouth in a parable. When Yahweh showed me this scripture, he told me to look at it in the context of an English sentence where you have a subject and a predicate. The subject is Psalm 78, verses 1 and 2. Give ear to my Torah. I will open my mouth in a parable. If you put that thought together, you understand what's being communicated. The Torah is a parable. But what is a parable? A parable is a spiritual meaning, an understanding of a spiritual truth that is not readily seen and discerned from the pashat or the literal application and understanding. So, one of the primary reasons why traditional Christians find it so boring to read the first part of their Bible, which they would call the Old Testament, is they view that it is mainly history, and most people don't like history, so they get bored in reading it. They want to go to something that they view as more exciting. However, the reason why it is boring to them is because they don't know the principle that biblical history is prophecy, that when they're reading history, they're gleaning insight about the first and second coming of Messiah and the events of the end of days. We can see this in Psalm 78, verses 1 and 2. Give ear, O my people, to my Torah. I will open my mouth in a parable. Psalm 78, verse 4 says, showing the generation to come. The word to come in the King James is the Strong's number 314. It's the Hebrew word acharon. And the most common translation of the word acharon is it means last or the end. So this could be rendered this way. Give ear, O my people, to my Torah. I will open my mouth in a parable showing the last generation. It is the last generation that will understand the parable of the Torah. Beginning in Genesis chapter 12 through 5 books, basically what it contains is the following. We're told how a covenant was made with Abraham, which Paul explains in Galatians 3:16. It's actually Yeshua the Messiah that made the covenant with Abraham. And that covenant was passed to Isaac and then to Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons who become heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. They go to Egypt, and they get redeemed out of Egypt, and they come to Mount Sinai, and they spend 40 years in the wilderness. That's basically what the Torah contains and details regarding those events. Why then is the understanding of the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the redemption from Egypt so important to understand? Because it is actually a parable. And Paul explains in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verses 1 through 4, where he tells primarily non-Jewish believers in Yeshua as the Messiah to not be ignorant how all of our fathers were under the cloud. They all passed through the sea. Speaking about the historical Egyptian redemption, it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for in samples or for a type and a shadow, but they're written for our admonition, our instruction, our learning, our encouragement. They're written for our encouragement upon whom the ends of the world or the ends of the ages are come. Therefore, Paul is explaining how the historical Egyptian Exodus is a prophetic foreshadowing of the ingathering of the exiles in the last generation. It is patterned and paralleled after the historical Egyptian redemption. As we're told in Micah in chapter 7 and verse 15, according to the days of your coming out of the land of Egypt, will I show unto him marvelous things. According to those historical days, will I show you marvelous things. And then in Hosea in chapter 2 and verse 15 says, I will give her her vineyards from there in the valley of Achor. Achor means trouble or troubling. The valley of trouble. The valley of trouble. Jacob's trouble. Jacob's trouble for a door of hope. As long as there is a separation of northern kingdom and southern kingdom, we're told in Ezekiel chapter 37 verse 11 that our hope is lost. So when it's talking about having hope, it's talking about the gathering of the exiles of Israel. The valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she will sing there as in the days of her youth. When did she sing? When Pharaoh and his army were drowned in the Red Sea. That's when Miriam and the children of Israel began to sing and dance. She shall sing as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. This is the parable of the Torah that the last generation will understand, is that the redemption of the tribulation is a parallel of historical Egyptian redemption. The other parallel, the other aspect of the Torah, which is a parable, is it was Yeshua the Messiah who made covenant with Abraham, who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, and who gave the Torah at Mount Sinai. Jews will understand that Yeshua is the Messiah, and Christians will understand that Yeshua is the lawgiver, that if you love him, you keep his commandments, which means you follow Torah, and he is going to gather the exiles of Israel in the end of days, which includes his family, the house of Jacob, which encompasses not only Jews, but believers in Yeshua as the Messiah as well. In Hosea chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, it says, because Ephraim has made many altars to sin, altar shall be made unto him to sin. I've written to him the great things of my Torah, but they were counted as a strange thing. We seem to have a perception problem here, because while most of Christianity views the Torah as a strange thing, something they don't want to follow, or they believe they shouldn't obey, the God of Israel regards this Torah as great. Why does the God of Israel regard his Torah as great? Well, we made reference to it earlier from Isaiah in chapter 46, verses 9 through 11, where it says, is there anyone like me? I declare the end from the beginning. He told us in the Torah about the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah, his first coming, his second coming. He told us about the disobedience of the children of Israel, their exile, their repentance, their gathering by the Messiah, and ultimately Messiah setting up his messianic kingdom. All these things is taught and communicated in the Torah. And who else can create a world, put human beings on this created world, enter into a covenant with a specific group of people in the world, and orchestrate their history to teach about the first and second coming of the Messiah and world history? Who can do that? Nobody can do that. That's why the God of Israel regards his Torah as being great, because the Torah teaches us these things. But it says Ephraim, who I believe is a reference to Christianity, counts the Torah as a strange thing. This, which is translated as strange thing, in Hosea chapter 8 in verse 12, is the Hebrew, it's the Strong's number 2114. It's the Strong's number 2114. And if we look at that in the Hebrew, it is the Hebrew word zor. And what this word zor means, it means to profane or to commit adultery against. It means whorish. So the God of Israel regards his Torah as being great, but Ephraim regards it as something as whorish, something you stay away from, something that you don't view in a positive light. Now, by understanding these principles, let's understand the background of the end-time battle between Jacob and Esau. The conflict between Jacob and Esau is prophesied in the birth of Jacob and Esau. In Genesis chapter 25, verses 21 through 23, we're told that Rebekah has twins, and they struggled and fought with each other in the womb. That is a prophecy that Jacob and Esau are going to fight against each other in each generation, coming to the final generation where the whole world will get involved in their conflict. Jacob's return to the land of Israel and to Zion in the end of days is foreshadowed in Genesis chapter 31, where after serving 20 years under Laban, which is a prophecy of 2,000 years of worldwide exile, that is from the first coming of Yeshua, that anti-Semitism rises up, where it is written in Genesis 31:1, and he heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's has he gotten all this glory. There's an accusation, a false accusation against Jacob, and then it says, and Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not toward him as before. So there's a change in way Jacob is perceived. And this change in perception is what we might call anti-Semitism. We have in the book of Exodus, in chapter 1, in verse 8, we're told the following. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. You see, it's a people in the world who don't have regard for the God of Israel or his people or his ways always is the precondition for persecution, affliction, bondage, and ultimately his people crying out because of this condition and redemption. We have then, as a result of Laban's sons not looking at Jacob the same as how he had been viewed. Genesis 31, verse 3, Yahweh says to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, and I will be with you. Why did he have to encourage him with the words, I will be with you? Because the return back and the challenges that were before him were difficult. He had to be encouraged with the words, I will be with you. So Jacob returns to the land of Israel, and he encounters Esau in his return. In Genesis, in chapter 32, in verse 3, it says, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, and commanded him, saying, you shall speak unto my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. And it says in verse 5, I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, men servants, and women servants, and I have sent to tell my Lord that I might find grace in your sight. He seeks to make peace with Esau. However, Esau is not in a peaceful mood. In Genesis 32, in verse 6, it says, Esau came to greet the messengers of Jacob with 400 men. This is a prophecy that in the end of days, when it's time to end the exile of the house of Jacob, that Jacob would seek to make peace, and the nation of Israel in the Western world is seeking to make peace in the Middle East. However, Esau wants to wage war. As a result of this, we have Genesis 32, verse 7, that Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. Being afraid and being distressed is an allusion to Jacob's trouble or the tribulation period. We have a prophecy that when it's time for Jacob to return home, that Esau would oppose him, which is an allusion to the controversy of Zion, and this brings about Jacob's tribulation. As a result of this, we're told in Genesis 32:24, that Jacob was left alone. That means no one in the world is showing sympathy for Jacob. The nations of the world are against Jacob. He's left alone, and there he wrestled with the man until the breaking of the day. If the tribulation is the darkness part of the day, the end of the tribulation is the breaking of the day. So Jacob is wrestling with a man until the end of the tribulation. This man is a reference to the Messiah. And the literal house of Jacob, personified by the Jewish people, was wrestling with, is Yeshua the Messiah or not? And Christianity, who biblically represents the redeemed house of Jacob, is wrestling with, you mean that in believing that he is the Messiah, that great problems are coming upon the earth and upon us because we're not following Torah? Really, we're supposed to be following Torah? And so both Judaism and Christianity will be wrestling with these things until the breaking of the day. In Genesis chapter 32, verse 7, where it talks about Jacob being greatly afraid and distressed, it's from this verse that Jeremiah picks up in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, that it is Jacob's trouble. In Genesis chapter 33 and verse 4, it tells us that Esau ran to meet Jacob. He embraced him and he kissed him. In a Torah scroll, under the words in Hebrew, and he kissed him, above those words you will find some dots. And dots aren't a part of Hebrew grammar. It's not a part of the Hebrew alphabet. It's not a part of Hebrew grammar. Which would cause the reader to come to this and notice the irregularity that is contained here, where you have the dots, cause one to ask, why the dots? There is a Torah teaching just on why the dots are there. The answer is, even though the text literally says that Esau kissed him, in his heart, he hated him and wasn't seeking peace, wasn't trying to make peace. And this can be rendered as he wanted to bite him. Or the kiss, being insincere, could be regarded as a kiss of death. And this is a reference to the peace efforts in the end of days, that in that effort to make peace, that Esau, personified by the PLO, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, Hamas, while they may be shaking hands and saying peace and hugging and kissing, it is insincere. It is an insincere gesture. Yeshua also had this kiss of death, and this kiss of death that he experienced was by Judas. It is a kiss of betrayal, is this kiss of death. In Isaiah, in chapter 28, the peace agreement is called a covenant of death. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 14, "Wherefore, hear the word of Yahweh, ye scornful men that rule this people which is in Jerusalem. Because you have made a covenant with death and with Hades, and we are in agreement." This covenant that Israel makes is with death. It is a kiss of death agreement. Let's look at the characteristics of the end time battle between Jacob and Esau. The first, we need to understand that biblically, Esau, Edom, and Mount Seir are synonymous terms. Esau, Edom, and Mount Seir are synonymous terms. Esau means red, and that's what Edom means. And historically, Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, which is a place of cave dwellings. Ezekiel chapter 35 is a prophecy and judgment against Mount Seir or Esau in the end of days. And it tells us why in Ezekiel 35 verse 5. "Because you have a perpetual hatred, and you shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword." What do we call the shedding of the blood of the children of Israel? We call it homicide or suicide bombings. Why does it say by the force of the sword? Because the sword is an allusion to Islam in the end of days, and a sword is one of the symbols of Islam, telling us that Esau would be Islamic in him shedding the innocent blood of the children of Israel. But then it says, in the time of their calamity. When is the time of their calamity? It is Jacob's trouble or the tribulation period. But it goes on to say, in the time that their iniquity had an end. What is the end of the iniquity? The iniquity is breaking the covenant at Mount Sinai. The punishment is exile into the nations. What's the end of the iniquity? It is the end of the exile of the house of Jacob. Therefore, we're told that this battle between Jacob and Esau, where Esau is shedding the blood of the children of Israel, it will ultimately end up in the end of the exile of the house of Jacob. In Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 5, it speaks about a judgment against Idumea. And in the King James, Idumea is just the Latin form of Edom or Esau. In Ezekiel chapter 36, verses 1 and 2, which is the continuation, of course, of Ezekiel chapter 35, the judgment against Esau, it says, "Son of man, prophesy unto the mountains of Israel, and say, ye mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh." This is a prophecy to the mountains of East, the mountains of Israel, which is Judea and Samaria, or the Western world refers to it as the West Bank. This is a prophecy unto the West Bank. Because of the controversy today surrounding the West Bank, we should therefore be paying close attention to this prophecy unto the mountains of Israel. The prophecy is this, Ezekiel 36:2. "Thus says Yahweh, because the enemy has said against you, aha, even the ancient high places are ours in possession." The prophecy against the mountains of Israel is that the enemy, who is Esau, would say that the mountains of Israel belongs to them. This is being carried out today by a people who are calling themselves the Palestinians, but biblically they're referred to as Esau. It goes on to say how Yahweh's got to respond to this. In Ezekiel 36:5, "Surely in the fire of my jealousy," this is another term for the judgment upon the nations, "have I spoken against the residue of the heathen and against all Idumea," that's those who are siding with Esau, "who have appointed my land for their possession with the joy of all their heart." What is the joy of the heart of the PLO? To get their state, because they want to have a state, have it recognized by the world, as a launching pad to wage war on the rest of Israel and drive it into the sea. And that is the despiteful minds to cast it for a prey that the verse goes on to explain. First two characteristics of the battle between Jacob and Esau is Esau is shedding the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword. Number two, he's saying that the mountains of Israel or the West Bank belongs to him. The third we're going to look at is Obadiah in chapter 1. The book of Obadiah is written in the setting of the Day of Yahweh, which is Obadiah in chapter 1 and verse 15. The book was written to tell us of the judgment upon Esau in the end of days for his violence against Jacob. Obadiah 1:1 speaks about the vision concerning Edom, or Esau. In Obadiah chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "The pride of your heart has deceived you, you that dwell in the clefts of the rock." Some translations say, "You that dwell in the caves of the rock." The word clefts or caves is the Strong's number 2288. It's the Hebrew word hagav, which means a place of concealment or retreat, a place of refuge, a place where you hide. And the United States is telling us that our main number one enemy in the war against terror is Al-Qaeda, headed by bin Laden. And we supposedly can't find bin Laden because he is hiding in caves. Hiding or dwelling in caves is a characteristic of Esau. Obadiah chapter 1 verse 10 says, "For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame will cover you and you'll be cut off forever." The word violence is the Strong's number 2555, and it is pronounced in Hebrew, Hamas. Hamas is the name of the prime terror organization of the PLO that refuses to recognize Israel. So the God of Israel is telling us through the Hebrew language exactly who the enemy is, what his intent is as well. He's waging a war of violence against Jacob. Next, we're going to look at Daniel 9:11 or Daniel 9:11. Daniel 9:11 says, "Yea, all Israel has transgressed your Torah, even by departing, that they may not obey my voice." Notice, not obeying the voice of Yahweh is synonymous with not following Torah. Therefore, the curse is poured upon us in the oath that is written in the Torah of Moses, the servant of Elohim, because we have sinned against him. The word curse is the Strong's number 423. And it consists of the Hebrew letters Aleph, Lamed, and He. In biblical Hebrew, you do not have vowels. So therefore, context determines what Hebrew word it actually is. The way I could pronounce Aleph, Lamed, and He is Allah. Because Israel won't follow the Torah, the curse, or Allah, is brought against them by the God of Israel. And when radical Islam does an act of violence, they do it in the name of Allah. Next, we're going to look at Daniel chapter 2, where we have Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and Daniel interprets that dream. In that dream, Nebuchadnezzar is shown a head of gold, which is Babylon himself, his kingdom. And then we have the arms of silver, representing the Media-Persia Empire. And then we have a kingdom of brass, which is Greece. Following that, we have the legs of iron, representing Rome. And then the toes, which is part iron and part clay, represents the beast system of the end of days. The toes represents the end, or the farthest extremity, the end of days. And it's the stone cut out without hands. That is Messiah's kingdom that crushes the toes. the beast system of the end of days, and he sets up his kingdom. And looking at the toes in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 41, it says, whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of iron, for as much as you saw iron mixed with clay. The toes represents iron, which is strength, and clay, which is soft. The word mixed is the Strong's number 6151. It's the Aramaic Arab. So it's telling you that the toes of the end of days will be iron, which represents the West or Western philosophy, Western power, Western civilization, and clay, representing the Arab world, and they will be mixed. How are they mixed today? But it says, for as much as you saw that the kingdom will be divided. It says, you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay, part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. This is speaking of the fact that even though there is a unity of this kingdom in how they're approaching and how they view the nation of Israel, it is the West, along with the Arab world, that is seeking to make a peace agreement with Israel. They're united in that effort, but they're divided in how they see the world. Because the West wants to set up one world government wherein you have secular humanistic values is the rule and reign of this one world government, wherein the Arab world doesn't want to be a part of secular humanist one world government. They want to live where they proclaim their religion above everything else, and that is Islam. And the belief of Islam, where they are going to have their religion supersede everything else, and there are Arab countries that want their countries to be run by Islamic law, that does not mix or merge with secular humanist one world government philosophy. So in that area, they are divided and they wage war against each other. Psalm 83 talks about a confederacy of nations that wants the nation of Israel to no longer be in remembrance. Psalm 83, verse 4, the enemies of the nation of Israel say, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. Psalm 83, verse 5, it says, they've consulted together with one consent, they are a confederate against you. And speaking about this confederacy, it begins to list who the confederacy is. Psalm 83, verse 6 says, the tabernacles of Edom, the tabernacles or the tents of Edom. So Edom is the umbrella entity of which the coalition is named after. We would say it biblically, the house of Esau, which is not just literally Esau, but all those who are affiliated with him, the house of Esau. So the tabernacles of Edom, which consists of the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagarines, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, Philistines, Tyre, Asher, and Lot. We would call these people the Arab peoples. Messiah is going to come and judge Esau once Jacob seeks the face of Yahweh. We see in Isaiah 63, verse 1, who is this that comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? It's he that speaks in righteousness, mighty to save. This is a reference to Yeshua the Messiah. It says in Isaiah 63:2, why are you red in your apparel and your garments like him that treads the wine fat? It's because the Messiah is fighting against Edom or Esau. That's why Revelation 19, verse 13, in describing Yeshua coming to set his feet down on the Mount of Olives, he's clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. What are then the characteristics of the end time battle between Jacob and Esau? It is that Esau is shedding the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword, homicide or suicide bombings. He's saying that the mountains of Israel is his possession, that is claiming the West Bank for a PLO state. He's hiding in caves. He's fighting violently against Jacob, which in Hebrew the word violence is Hamas. And because Israel won't follow the Torah, the curse is poured out upon Israel. That is Allah. And it is a part of an end time system. Esau is a part of an end time system that seeks to destroy Israel. And it says in Daniel chapter 2, verse 41, that the iron is mixed Arab with clay. The events of the tribulation is what the Bible calls the controversy of Zion. The tribulation event surrounds a controversy of Zion, which is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 34 and verse 8. In order to understand the controversy of Zion, we need to understand who or what is Zion. Because the present nation of Israel is not biblical Zion. Biblical Zion is the unity of the redeemed people of the God of Israel, a redemption performed by the Messiah who are following Torah. The present nation of Israel is not seeking to follow Torah, not making laws to follow Torah. They want to be like the nations of the world. They are trusting in making agreements with the nations of the world, and even their arch enemy, the PLO, they're not seeking and trusting in the God of Israel. Because there's a misunderstanding of biblical Zion, we have in evangelical Christianity those who refer themselves as Christian Zionists. And what that basically means and what that communicates is they stand for the support of the Jewish people, the land of Israel, Jerusalem, the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Should we support the Jewish people? Yeah. Should we support the land of Israel? Yeah. Should we love the city of Jerusalem? Yeah. Should we believe in the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Yeah. So those principles are biblical. They are valid that Christian Zionists uphold. But Christian Zionism puts forth the thought of supporting the nation of Israel, the government, the secular government of the nation of Israel, and they are not biblical Zion. Furthermore, Christian Zionists don't realize and understand that Zion in the end of days is a term for Messiah who gathers both houses of Israel and unites them and brings them back to the land of Israel. Christian Zionists are not looking to be a part of the end gathering of the end of days. They are looking to be raptured. So they're saying Zion is somebody besides themselves. However, because the Messiah died on the tree to gather the exiles of Israel, him gathering a redeemed people and all of his family who are grafted in is a part of a completed work of Yeshua dying on the tree. Now let's look at who or what is biblical Zion. Zion is a term for the people of the God of Israel. Zion is a term for the land of Israel itself. The Torah goes forth from Zion. Zion is the fulfillment of the covenant made with Abraham. Zion is a term that the Bible gives for the end of the exile of Jacob. Zion is a term for the Messianic era. And Zion is the Messiah, Yeshua, redeeming and dwelling with His people. Let's look at these scriptures. Isaiah 51, verse 16. Zion is a term for the people of Yahweh. Say unto Zion, you are my people. Joel chapter 2, verse 1. Zion is a term for the land of Israel itself. Blow a trumpet in Zion. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. The Torah goes forth from Zion. Speaking about the Messianic era, it says in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3, many people shall go and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us His ways, we will walk in His paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Torah and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. In understanding biblical Zion, we need to realize that it's Yeshua who made a covenant with Abraham. In Genesis chapter 12, and verse 1 and verse 3, we see Yahweh appearing to Abram. And by doing some cross-referencing of Genesis 17, verse 1, with Revelation chapter 1, verses 7 and 8, we can see that the one that made covenant with Abraham is El Shaddai, which is a term for Yeshua the Messiah. Genesis 17, verse 1, when Abram was 90 years old and 9, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am Almighty God, or I am El Shaddai. Revelation 1, verses 7 and 8, speaking about Yeshua, it says, behold, He comes with clouds, and every eye will see Him. Then it says, He's the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the ending, says Yahweh, which is, which was, which is to come, the Almighty. The Almighty is El Shaddai. Yeshua is called the Almighty. The Almighty appeared to Abraham. Yeshua made covenant with Abraham. In Genesis 17, verse 7, Paul quotes in Galatians 3, verse 16. Genesis 17, 7 says, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you, in their generations, for an everlasting covenant. Paul makes special note that Genesis 17:7 says seed, it does not say seeds. Galatians 3:16, now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He didn't say seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Messiah. Then he goes on to say, if you are Messiah's, then you are Abraham's seed and an heir according to the promise. I want you to notice that a believer in Yeshua the Messiah is an heir of what He promised to Abraham. What are the two main things that was promised to Abraham? A son and a land. The fulfillment of that son was Isaac, but it foreshadowed Yeshua the Messiah, who would be of Abraham, of the house of David. He also promised him a land. Christians don't traditionally look forward to returning to Zion, to the land of Israel. They're all preoccupied with being raptured. In doing so, they are not claiming their inheritance that Messiah has for them, based upon the covenant that was made with Abraham. And in doing so, they're actually acting like Esau, who despised his birthright and wouldn't enter into and pursue his inheritance. We should be claiming our inheritance in Yeshua the Messiah, which is claiming the land that He promised to Abraham for us. Believing the covenant made with Abraham is the comfort of Zion. Isaiah 51, verses 1 through 3. Hearken to me, you that follow after righteousness. Look unto Abraham, your father. When you look unto Abraham, what do you look unto? the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's by believing that covenant and understanding that Yeshua the Messiah made that covenant with Abraham is how Yahweh will comfort Zion. Because Yahweh, that is Yeshua the Messiah, He is going to stand up and defend the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We can see how the comfort of Zion is associated with the end of the exile of Jacob. Jeremiah 31, verse 10 says, He that scattered Israel, who scattered Israel? The rock scattered them, Deuteronomy 32, will gather him. Therefore they shall come and sing in the height of Zion, and He will turn their mourning to joy and will comfort them. Zion is the end of the exile of Jacob, or the gathering of the exiles, as we can see in Psalm 147, verse 2. Yahweh builds up Jerusalem, He gathers together the outcasts of Israel. Isaiah 11, verse 12 tells us that He will gather Israel and Judah. Yeshua will return when the exiles of Zion are gathered. Psalm 102, verse 13. You will arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time has come. When Yahweh builds up Zion, what is building up of Zion? It's gathering together the exiles of Israel. When He builds up Zion, He shall appear in His glory. Isaiah, in chapter 8 and verse 14, speaks of the Messiah. It is written, And He shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. This verse is quoted in Romans chapter 9, verse 33. Let's look at that. Romans chapter 9 and verse 33. Which says, As it is written, Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone of a rock of offense, and whoever believes on Him shall not be ashamed. Also, it's mentioned in 1 Peter in chapter 2 and verse 8. 1 Peter chapter 2, talking about Messiah, He's a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Therefore, Isaiah 8:14 is speaking about the Messiah, and He's the stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. How is Yeshua a stone of stumbling to Judah? They don't believe He's the Messiah. How is He a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to Christianity? Because while they believe He's the Messiah, they don't want to follow Torah, even though He is the lawgiver. Speaking of Yeshua, it says in Isaiah 8:17, And I will wait upon Yahweh that hides His face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for Him. Who is the one that both houses of Israel are looking for? The Messiah. Judaism, for the first time, they say. Christianity, for the second time. The one that they're looking for and waiting upon is hiding His face from the house of Jacob. Why is He hiding His face? In other words, why isn't He fully revealed? When is Messiah fully revealed? It is in His day, the day of Yahweh. That's the subject of the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 1 says, Revelation 1:1, the revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach, which means He's not yet fully revealed. Even though He's been preached for 2,000 years, He's not yet fully revealed. When will He be fully revealed? In the day of Yahweh. Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, on the day of Yahweh. John was shown events and things that happened in the day of Yahweh, in the thousand-year messianic era. Yeshua is hiding His face. Why? It's because His people won't follow His Torah. Deuteronomy in chapter 31, verses 16 and 17. Yahweh said to Moses, Behold, you will sleep with your fathers, and this people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake Me and break My covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them. And Deuteronomy 31, verse 18, it says in the King James, I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evils which they have wrought, and that they've turned to other gods. The words surely hide in the Hebrew, it says, I will hide my face. The reason why Yeshua is hiding his face is because his people won't follow his Torah. In Isaiah, in chapter 54, verses 7 and 8, it says, For a small moment have I forsaken you, but with great mercies will I gather you. It's talking about gathering the exiles of Israel. In a little wrath I hid my face from you for a moment. That's exile. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on you. That's redemption, says Yahweh, your Redeemer. So the one that we're waiting upon, that is Yeshua the Messiah, that we're looking for him, it says in the next verse in Isaiah 8:18, that he dwells in Mount Zion, which means that's where he's going to be revealed, in Mount Zion. Where do you see Yeshua and those following him in Revelation chapter 14? Verse 1 says, I looked and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. He dwells in Mount Zion. Joel chapter 3 verse 6, it says, Yahweh will roar out of Zion. Who roars? The Lion of the tribe of Judah. Revelation 5:5. Deuteronomy 32 verse 9, we're told that Jacob is the inheritance of the God of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. In Exodus chapter 6 verse 8, we're told that the land of Israel is the inheritance of the nation of Israel. I will bring you into the land concerning which I did swear to give it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it for a heritage. Next, Deuteronomy 33, verse 4, the Torah is the inheritance of the nation of Israel. Moses commanded us a Torah, even the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. So reviewing, what we have is Jacob is the inheritance of the God of Israel, but the land of Israel is the heritage of the nation of Israel, and the Torah is the inheritance of the nation of Israel. Therefore, we have a unity of the people, the land, and the Torah, headed by the Messiah. This is biblical Zion. If the enemy wants to divide Zion, he has to divide this unity. And we currently have a division in Zion today because we have the Jewish people who understand that they are the people of Yahweh, and they realize the land of Israel is what was promised to them, and they seek to follow Torah, but not the Torah of the Messiah. They don't believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. Christianity believes that Yeshua is Messiah, but they don't believe that they're the promised people. They don't believe that the land of Israel is theirs, and they don't believe that they should follow Torah. So, biblical Zion does not exist today. What is the controversy of Zion? The controversy of Zion is over the people of Yahweh who follow Torah, and by following Torah, they believe that the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is an eternal inheritance of the seed of Abraham. The Messiah will fight for Zion. Remember, we're told in Ezekiel 36, verses 1 and 2, that Esau wants to make the mountains of Israel his possession. The fight of Zion is a fight over the land of Israel. Jeremiah chapter 30 verse 17 says, remember the setting of this is Jeremiah 30 verse 7, Jacob's trouble. Continuing on, Jeremiah 30 verse 17, it says, I will restore health unto you. Health is the end of the exile of Jacob. And I will heal you of your wound. The wound is the exile, says Yahweh, because they called you an outcast, saying, This is Zion, which no man seeks after. this is lightly worded in the English. In order to really understand what's being communicated, we need to see it in the Hebrew. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, where it says, they called, is the Strong's number 7121. It's the Hebrew word kara, and it means to approach and speak in a challenging or an aggressive way. We use the expression in our society, you're in my face, to come and speak in a challenging and aggressive way, saying, this is Zion which no man speaks after, calling you an outcast. Outcast is the Strong's number 5080. It's the Hebrew word nadak, which means to drive out or expel. So when they come to Zion and they approach you in a challenging and aggressive way and they tell you, you must be expelled or driven out of your land, that is when Yahweh is going to redeem Zion. Joel chapter 3 verse 6 tells us that the children of Judah and the children of Jerusalem had you sold to the Grecians. Sold means exiled or expelled or driven out, that you might remove them far from their border. Is there a world power today known as the Grecian Empire who's telling the nation of Israel and the Jews to leave their homes? The answer is no. But why are the Jews being told to leave their homes? Bush's foreign policy in the Middle East is to bring about what type of government to Iraq? What type of PLO state? A democratic PLO state. And where do we get a democratic Iraq? And where do we get democracy from? From the Greeks. So this should be rendered, the children of Judah and the children of Jerusalem have you sold for the sake of democracy, and that's the way in which you were telling them to leave their homes. It is happening today. The controversy of Zion, or Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, will bring about the end of the exile of the house of Jacob. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 17. It's during Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, that Israel and Judah will return to the land and possess it, Jeremiah 30, verse 3. Earlier, we looked at major events of the day of the Lord. Let's review them. Number one, Gaza will be forsaken. In the day of the Lord, Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, Gaza will be forsaken, Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 4. Joel chapter 1, verse 15, in the day of the Lord, the nation, the land of Israel will be divided. Joel chapter 3, verse 2. In the day of the Lord, Zechariah 14, verse 1, Jerusalem will be divided. Zechariah 14, verse 2. It will bring about the judgment of the nation. Zechariah 14, verse 3. The judgment is nuclear. Zechariah 14, verse 12. This is the plague where Yahweh will smite all the people that fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh will consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. I believe that is chemical, biological, nuclear warfare. What nation in the world is leading the effort to create a PLO state? It is the United States of America. Therefore, once we see the creation of that Palestinian state and the dividing of the city of Jerusalem, making East Jerusalem the capital of a Palestinian state, after we see that, we will see chemical, biological, nuclear warfare upon the United States of America. Once the land of Israel is divided, it results in the judgment of the nations. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7 speaks about Jacob's trouble. Then verse 11 talks about the judgment of the nations. I will make a full end of all nations where I have scattered you. This is all called the controversy of Zion. The reason why the nations of the world are being judged, Isaiah 34:1, Isaiah 34:2, the reason why there's indignation of Yahweh upon all the nations is because of Isaiah 34:8, the controversy of Zion, because Jews are being removed from their homes. When judgment of the nations comes, Babylon will fall. Babylon falls in the day of Yahweh. Isaiah 13, verse 1 talks about the burden of Babylon. Verse 6, it's the day of Yahweh, and Babylon will fall and be overthrown as when Yahweh overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Isaiah 13, verse 19. When we're talking about Babylon, we need to understand that Babylon is a generic term for the kingdom of darkness, and Babel, the Strong's number 894, means confusion by mixing. Historically, in Genesis chapter 11, there was a rebellion against the God of Israel, and they tried to build a tower to exalt themselves. That was called the Tower of Babel. But the God of Israel came and destroyed that tower, brought about confusion upon them. This is a prophecy of the end of days, that when the nations of the world tried to establish a world without the God of Israel, He will come and judge them and bring confusion upon their affairs. This is what is mentioned in Psalm in chapter 2. Psalm chapter 2 says the following, beginning in verse 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The vain thing is the Tower of Babel. The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against His anointed, that's Zion, saying, come, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords. He that sits in the heavens shall laugh. Yahweh will have them in derision. That is the judgment upon the Tower of Babel, which in the end of days is the effort to bring about one world government. This is associated with Messiah redeeming His people and Him ruling and reigning from Zion. It says in Psalm chapter 2, verse 6, yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. To reiterate, when we're talking about Babylon, we need to realize that there is a physical land of Babylon, and that physical land of Babylon is in the area which we call today Iran and Iraq. There is a financial Babylonian system. Our monetary system of the world is not a Torah-based system. It's a Babylonian financial system. Then there is a religious Babylonian system. The religions of the world not recognizing the creator of the universe, Yeshua HaMashiach, that He is the way and the truth and the life, is a religious Babylonian system. I'm not going to be speaking about the physical land of Babylon or financial Babylon or religious Babylon. What I'm focusing on is an end-time spiritual land of Babylon that will be judged through and because of the dividing of the land of Israel. I believe this is the United States of America, and let's look at the characteristics of the United States as the spiritual land of Babylon. In Genesis chapter 49, verse 1, it is written, Jacob called unto his sons and says, gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. The word last is the Strong's number 319. It's the Hebrew word akarit. Of course, it's translated here last. That word appears in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 12, speaking about Babylon, where the King James says that Babylon is the hindermost of the nations, or the last of the nations. Babylon is an end-time nation. Babylon is economically prosperous. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 37 says, a sword is upon her treasures. Jeremiah 51, verse 13 says, she's abundant in treasures. Babylon is a world military power. Jeremiah 51, verse 53 says, though Babylon should mount up to heaven, and though she should fortify the height of her strength, yet from me shall come spoilers, says Yahweh. In the years 2001 and 2003, the United States had over 730 military installations and bases in over 50 countries of the world. Babylon has defeated mighty kingdoms through war. Jeremiah 51, verse 20. You are my battle axe and weapons of war, for with you will I break in pieces the nations, and with you will I destroy kingdoms. Babylon dwells upon many waters, Jeremiah 51, verse 13. O you that dwell upon many waters. We have the Atlantic Ocean on the east side of the United States. We have the Atlantic, we have the Pacific Ocean on the west side of the United States. To the south is the Gulf of Mexico. We have the Great Lakes to the north. We have the mighty Mississippi going through the middle of the country. And Minnesota itself is called the land of 10,000 lakes. Babylon is a melting pot of nations, Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 37. Babylon is referred to as a mingled people. Babylon does not believe that she will experience judgment, Isaiah 47, verse 5 and verse 8. It says that she will no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms, that she dwells carelessly and says in her heart, I am, there's none like me. I will not sit as a widow. I will not experience bad things. And most of America and even Christians don't believe that bad things will come to America. They believe, Christians believe they're going to be raptured before they see any bad things come to America. But we're told in Jeremiah 50, verse 32, that a fire is kindled in the cities of Babylon. In Jeremiah 50, verse 9, we're told that an assembly of great nations from the north country attacked Babylon and caused her to fall. Biblically speaking, the word north means evil. It means bad things. North means evil or bad things in the Bible. So saying that it comes from the north country means this is an assembly of nations to oppose the United States of America. Right now, there is a world coalition that is forming and has formed opposing the United States. It is Russia, China, it is North Korea, it is Iran, it is Syria, it is Hamas, it is Venezuela, it is Cuba, it is other South American countries that's aligning itself with Venezuela. Why are these nations opposing the United States? It is because the United States is heading the effort to bring about one world government and making it possible for one world government to be set up. The nations of the world know how close we are to this and the reality of it, but they do not want the United States or the Western world or the Western bankers telling them what to do like they've told them what to do since World War II. They want to tell the world what to do, and they are now arming themselves to bring down the United States of America so that in their minds they can rule the world. The enemy attack against Babylon is devastating. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 14, it says, shoot at her and spare no arrows. Babylon is destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 14. And it says, so that no man will abide there. Babylon will be totally destroyed, Jeremiah 51, verse 29. It will be desolate without an habitation. But you have to understand how the God of Israel brings judgment. He brings it in stages and in degrees. So when the United States gets attacked, that initial attack from an assembly of nations will not cause the United States to be without an inhabitant. Babylon falls in stages. Babylon is fallen. It falls in stages. And it says in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 50, you who have escaped the sword, that means there will be an escaping of the sword upon Babylon, that you who escaped the initial attack, let Jerusalem come to your mind. The world is astonished at the fall of Babylon, Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 46, and a cry is heard among the nations. Babylon has a heritage that is destroyed. This country was founded by those seeking religious freedom and to be able to worship the God of Israel without persecution. And among the early settlers of this country were the pilgrims. However, that heritage has been destroyed, and it has been very much eroded in this past generation. Babylon is cut off in the time of harvest, Jeremiah 50, verse 16. Cut off the sower from Babylon in the time of the harvest. Yeshua said in Matthew 13, 39, that the harvest is the end of the ages. Yahweh would heal Babylon, but it refuses to repent. Jeremiah 51, verses 8 and 9, Babylon is suddenly fallen. We would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. Forsake her. Many Jews and Christians who live in Babylon will be called to leave this country and ask the way to Zion. Jeremiah 50, verse 4, in those days and in that time, that's referring to the day of Yahweh, the children of Israel will come, they and the children of Judah together, going and weeping, that is repenting, and they will go and seek the Lord their God, and they will ask the way to Zion. What you are hearing today is a message that gives you the way to Zion. There are hardly any Jews and Christians that live in Iran and Iraq. Very few. There's a few, but not very many. The nation of the world that has the most Jews and Christians is the United States of America. That's why in Jeremiah 50, verse 4, the children of Israel and the children of Judah are asking the way to Zion. The reason for fleeing the United States is because of the sword that comes upon the land. Jeremiah 50, verse 16, for fear of the oppressing sword, they shall flee everyone to his own land. Then it says in Jeremiah 51, verse 50, you that have escaped the sword, let Jerusalem come to your mind. What is the way to Zion then? It is the unification of the people of the God of Israel who stand for and embrace the land of Israel or Zion, believing the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They seek to follow Torah, and they are headed or led by the Messiah who redeems his people and sets up his kingdom, teaching the Torah to all nations. It's the cry of the watchman who says, let us go up to Zion. Jeremiah 31, verse 6, there shall be a day, I'd like to submit to you that day is today, that the watchman, I'd like to submit that this is a watchman message that you're hearing, upon Mount Ephraim shall cry, arise and let us go up to Zion unto the Lord our God. The last part of sharing with you the events of the end of days and the things that are going to be happening that brings about the redemption of Zion is that when a PLO state gets established, that there is going to be a rebellion by the sons of Zion against the sons of Greece. This is prophesied in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 13. When I have bent Judah for me and filled the bow with Ephraim, and I've raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece. This rebellion is likened to the rebellion that is spoken of in the book of Daniel, wherein Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who is a type of the false Messiah and the oppressor of the end of days of Zion, sought to impose his will upon his people, and a remnant who wanted to stand for the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob rebelled and against all odds succeeded and overcame the evil decrees of Antiochus. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 16 and verse 22, in speaking about the people of the God of Israel being exiled in the nations of the world, the nations of the world are likened to beasts of the field, Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 22. In Deuteronomy 28, verse 64, it says, Yahweh scattered you among all people. Ezekiel 34, 5 says, they were scattered and they became meat to all the beasts of the field. Because the nations of the world are likened unto beasts of the field, that is why the dreams and visions in the book of Daniel that the nations of the world are personified as beasts. We're now going to look at Daniel in chapter 8. The background is we have the fall of the Media-Persian Empire and the rise of the Greek Empire. Ultimately, the one that led the Grecian victory against the Persian Empire is an individual named Alexander the Great. However, he died at a young age, and his kingdom was split into four kingdoms. And looking at the prophecy that Antiochus would die at a young age, in Daniel 8:8 it says, "Therefore the goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken." The dividing of Alexander's kingdom is mentioned in Daniel 8:8. "And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. The two strongest of the four kingdoms were the Seleucids of the north, associated with Syria, and the Ptolemies of the south, associated with Egypt. From the Seleucid Empire came one Antiochus Epiphanes," Daniel 8:9, "and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land." Here we have a coin where Antiochus is portrayed as Zeus. Why is he portrayed as Zeus? Because in Greek mythology, Zeus is the supreme god of all gods. So being personified as Zeus, he's making a declaration that he is the god of all gods. Israel became the battleground of the conflict between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and ultimately Antiochus waged war against the Jews, and in waging war against the Jews, he made different decrees. In 1 Maccabees, we have details of these events and what Antiochus did. And among the things that Antiochus did unto the Jewish people is he destroyed the vessels of the temple. In 1 Maccabees 1:21, it says, "He entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar and the candlestick of light and all the vessels thereof." It continues on in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 22 through 25, giving the detail of that. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, it says that through peace, Antiochus destroyed or deceived many. In 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 29, this is repeated, continuing on in verse 30 where it says, "And he spoke peaceable words, but they were all of deceit." You see, the effort to make peace in the end of days is a peace based upon deception, not a genuine desire for peace. Daniel chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, we're told that Antiochus stopped the daily sacrifice in the temple, which is referred to as the abomination of desolation. This is also mentioned in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 54, 56, and verse 59. In Daniel chapter 11, verse 31, Antiochus set up the abomination of desolation. Antiochus did two things. He set up a statue of Zeus, which is an abomination according to the Torah, and he sacrificed the pig upon the altar, which is also an abomination. He did this as an act of rebellion. Now, in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, Yeshua said, "When you see," that's future, "the abomination of desolation," spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So when Yeshua is talking about in the end of days an abomination of desolation, he's referring to what historically happened in the book of Daniel and the rebellion that ensued as a result of the abomination of desolation and the victory in and against the abomination of desolation is what we regard as the celebration of Hanukkah today. Yeshua is telling that there's going to be a rebellion in the end of days where a people who will stand with the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is going to defeat one that is more powerful and mighty in the natural than the rebels. That is because the Messiah is going to fight for the rebels who are biblically called Zion. Then Yeshua said in Matthew 24:16 that them, let them that which are in Judea flee in the mountains. Well, that is what happened historically, because we find in 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verse 1, that Mattathias and his five sons, when they rebelled, we're told in 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verse 28, that they fled into the mountains. So what Yeshua says that is to be done has already been done. Why did Antiochus make a statue of Zeus? Because Zeus is the god of all gods in Greek mythology. And Zeus married Europa. Zeus in Greek mythology is personified as a bull. Europa is a woman who rides the bull. We have this imagery in Revelation chapter 17. Here we have an ancient art figure that was found in a ruin, and we see a woman riding upon a bull. This is Zeus and Europa. Next, we're going to look at a 1984 British European Parliament stamp, and that stamp shows a woman riding on a bull. This tells us that those who founded the European Union know that they're trying to recreate the Tower of Babel, and they want to build a one-world government that does not recognize the God of Israel, nor do they want him in their affairs. This here is a picture of an artist's rendition of the Tower of Babel by Peter Bruegel in 1563. On the right is a picture of the current European Parliament building in Strasbourg, France. As you can see, they built the European Parliament building to represent and to personify the Tower of Babel. The nations of the world and the nations of the West and of Europe are making a declaration that they are building the Tower of Babel to oppose the God of Israel. Antiochus IV decreed a world that would follow Greek culture. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 41 says, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people. In verse 42, everyone should leave his own laws, so all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. What the planners of one world government are doing is they're trying to do away with the sovereignty of nations, and so that the nations of the world will follow world law and world ideology, and there be one ideology that the people of the world would follow, and they want to do away with the cultures of people and individual sovereign nations. Antiochus decreed the outlawing of following Torah. 1 Maccabees 1:44. The king sent letters to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land. And he did the following. He forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, that they should profane the Sabbath and the festival days, and they sacrificed swine's flesh and unclean beasts, to the end that they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 44, 45, 47, and verse 49. That whoever would not follow the decree of the king was subject to death. The king sent letters by his messengers to Jerusalem, to the cities of Judah, that they should follow the strange laws of the land. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 50, that whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, that he should die. This is a prophecy to come, that the New World Order will demand that those who do not pledge allegiance to their system, they will say that the punishment is a punishment of death. Those who's going to rebel against that system is going to be Zion, personified by Daniel, who would not bow to the decree of King Nebuchadnezzar. He was thrown into a fiery furnace, which means trial and tribulation, but he was delivered by the Messiah. Now, let's look at the evil decrees of Antiochus IV. as is recorded in First Maccabees. It is among the following: that the people should not follow Torah, that they should not circumcise their children, they should not celebrate the Sabbath, they should not keep the festivals, sacrifices should not be made in the temple, and the people are free to eat anything they want and encouraged to eat pig. Do you realize that these decrees of Antiochus, which in First Maccabees is called evil decrees of Antiochus, these are the exact same teachings in traditional Christianity that they say Paul teaches in his epistles. These, what is called the evil decrees of Antiochus, is the same belief system that traditional Christianity says that Paul teaches in the New Testament. How did we get from the evil decrees of Antiochus, where there was a rebellion against them, to such a complete acceptance of this belief system, so much that people regard that this is the way that you follow the Messiah? You see, what the enemy did was, because he got defeated in the natural, militarily, he tried to incorporate the philosophy into the belief system of the people, because he could not conquer militarily. Anti-Torah is the spirit of anti-Messiah. One of the main things that makes the anti-Messiah, is he declares a non-observance of Torah. Antiochus' decree against circumcision is found in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 44. His decree not to observe the Sabbath and feast days is in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 45. His decree that sacrifices should not be made in the temple is in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 45. And his decree that people should eat pig is also found in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 45. What was the reaction among Jews to this decree of Antiochus the Fourth? There were two responses. The majority of Jews wanted to go along with the decrees of Antiochus in Greek culture for the sake of peace and not being noticed and singled out by the Greeks. However, there was a minority who would not accept it, who rebelled and said, no, we're going to follow the Torah and the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These group of rebels are called the Maccabees. This is a prophecy of the end of days, that the situation with the nation of Israel today is the nation of Israel is like the Hellenistic Jews that wants to be a part of this one world order system and be like the nations of the world, work with the nations of the world, even against the laws by the nations of the world that go against Torah. Then there's got to be a minority who the Bible calls Zion, who's got to rebel against the New World Order system and the government of Israel that wants to be a part of this New World system. The Bible calls these rebels Zion. What is the current situation with the government of Israel today? They embrace a Western culture. They have a democratic system of government. They pass laws and promote ideology of secular humanism, and they want to be like the nations of the world. They are willing to make a peace agreement with the PLO based upon UN resolutions 242 and 338. So the present government of Israel is like the Hellenistic Jews of old who submitted to Antiochus Epiphanes and his evil decrees. Next, we want to understand how that the peace process is based upon UN resolutions 242, 338, and 1397. The main point of understanding this is that when a PLO state is created, that the existence of that state will be world law, meaning that if you oppose that state, you are opposing world law, which will be punishable by death. What that means is that when Zion rebels against the PLO state, there is a death decree upon Zion. There's a death decree for standing with the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the enemies of Zion, which is a parallel to the historical Egyptian redemption. Because in Exodus, in chapter 4 and verse 22, it says, "You shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. I say unto you, let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, even your firstborn." So Pharaoh tried to kill the children of Israel, and the God of Israel says, "No, I'm defending my people. If you try to kill my firstborn, I'm going to kill your firstborn." And ultimately, the tenth plague was the slaying of the firstborn. The modern state of Israel was founded by secular Zionists. Not biblical Zionists, secular Zionists. And leading the effort was Theodor Herzl. In 1897, he called the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. The purpose of it was to seek a national homeland for the Jewish people. Herzl witnessed how Jews were being treated harshly in exile, and he thought that the nations would no longer persecute the Jewish people if they had their own homeland. Theodor Herzl died at a young age, and the Zionist cause was picked up, that is the secular Zionist cause, was picked up by Chaim Weizmann, and he helped the Allies in World War II he was a chemist, and he found a solution whereas he was able to supply acetone to produce munitions to help the war effort. And in reward for helping the Allies win World War I, Britain decreed what is called the Balfour Declaration to work for the establishment of a state of Israel. This picture in green comprised the area of the British Mandate. However, the Jews protested, and therefore land was given for peace. And this land that was given for peace from the original British Mandate today is known as Jordan. Ultimately, Britain couldn't handle the bitter struggle between the Jews and the Arabs over this issue. So they turned the issue of the area over to the United Nations. In 1947, the UN came up with their solution. And the solution was to create a Jewish state, an Arab state, and to make Jerusalem an international city. That, by the way, is the solution that's being proposed now. A Israeli state, an Arab state, which they're calling a PLO state now, because there wasn't a PLO in 1947, and to make Jerusalem an international city. Therefore, the nations of the world are still trying to bring in an agreement, a solution to the Middle East, based upon the UN resolutions. Making Jerusalem an international city is UN Resolution 181. This is a map of the 1949 armistice lines. The 1949 armistice agreements are a set of agreements signed between Israel and its neighbors, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, and it defines the borders between them. The ultimate talk is that in a peace agreement will be made between Israel and the PLO, and the PLO wants the peace agreement to be made upon based upon the 1949 borders. Israel obtained the Sinai in the Gaza Strip from Egypt in the 67 war, and they also obtained the Golan Heights from Syria, as well as what's called the West Bank from Jordan. As a result, following the June 67 war, these lands that Israel gained by defeating her Arab neighbors began to be called occupied territories. There was a UN Security Council resolution passed November the 22nd, 1967, following the Six-Day War called UN Resolution 242. This resolution is based upon peace and security. Peace and security with recognized boundaries. Paul said, when they say peace and safety, or peace and security, then sudden destruction. Following the 1973 Yom Kippur War, the UN passed Security Council Resolution 338, which affirmed UN Security Council Resolution 242. These two UN resolutions are in the peace agreements that Israel made with her Arab neighbors following that time. The first one being in 1979 with Egypt. This agreement was made March the 26th, 1979. And in the preamble, it says that this peace between Israel and Egypt is based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. Goes on to say that any agreement in the future between Israel and her neighbors will be based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. On September the 9th, 1993, Yasser Arafat wrote a letter to Prime Minister Rabin. And in this letter, he said that the PLO recognizes the right of the State of Israel to exist in peace and security, and the PLO accepts UN Resolutions 242 and 338. When Yasser Arafat died, Mahmoud Abbas took over for him. Mahmoud Abbas has stated that he is willing to abide by UN Resolutions 242 and 338. Because he is, he's regarded as a good guy by the nations of the world in Israel. And the reason why Hamas is regarded as a bad guy is because they won't abide by UN Resolutions 242 and 338. Is the United States trying to ensure that Mahmoud Abbas and the PLO are sincere in their efforts to make peace with Israel, and unless they prove that they're sincere, that they won't engage in peace talks? The answer is no, because being sincere about peace is not the issue. The issue is that an agreement is based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. That is the God that they're seeking to follow, not genuine peace. On September the 9th, 1993, Yitzhak Rabin wrote a letter back to Yasser Arafat recognizing the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. September the 13th, 1993, we have Oslo. And in the Oslo Agreement, in Article 1, it says the aim of the negotiations is to have a peace process based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. Then we have a peace treaty between Israel and Jordan, October the 26th, 1994. And in the preamble, it says that the peace agreement is based upon UN Resolutions 242 and 338. March the 12th, 2002, we have UN Security Council Resolution 1397, which affirms UN Resolutions 242 and 338. And UN Resolution 1397 says that peace in the area will be based upon a two-state solution, Israel and a PLO state living side by side with secure and recognized borders. These resolutions, 242338 and 1397, got rolled into what is called the Saudi Peace Initiative of March 28, 2002, where they affirm those resolutions. And then the roadmap of April 30, 2003. In the roadmap language, it says that peace will be negotiated based upon UN resolutions 242338 and 1397. Next is a commentary written by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the Secretary of State for Jimmy Carter. And he said, he was the National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter. He said that it's always been the United States policy that a peace agreement between Israel and her Arab neighbors would be based upon the 1949 armistice lines. Very significant admission, because that has never historically over the years been stated by U.S. presidents, even though they say that has been the official policy. We're nearing the end of this presentation, and what we're going to do here in finalizing this presentation is to show you not only that there's going to be a Zionist rebellion against the PLO state, but we're going to let you know when that rebellion is going to take place and the duration of time given to gather the exiles of Israel. This Zionist rebellion will be by Ephraim and Judah, who want to stand for the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, want to stand for the land of Israel. Messiah will fight for Zion and bring judgment upon the nations. It will result in the ingathering of the exiles. Zion is a nation born in one day, and it's born during the tribulation period. Isaiah 66, verse 8. Who has heard such a thing? Who has seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Notice Zion is born in one day, and it's born during her travail, which speaks of tribulation. In Isaiah chapter 66, verse 14, it says, when you see this, your heart will rejoice. Why? Because it means the end of the exile. It means Messiah setting up his kingdom. Then it says, the hand of the Lord will be known to his servants. It will be just like it was in Egypt. Remember, there was a distinction made between Goshen and Egypt. That is the hand of Yahweh known to his servants, and at the same time, his indignation toward his enemies. This is the fulfillment of Malachi in chapter 3 in verse 17 and 18. And they shall be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. Then you will return, you will discern, or between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. When does that happen? When does Yahweh make a distinction visibly to the world between those who serve him and those who don't? When Zion is born. Psalm 126, verse 1, the return of the captivity of Zion is likened to a dream and likened to laughter. When Yahweh turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter. If you tell a logical person that we are on the horizon of time when Yahweh is going to gather his people from all the nations where he'd been scattered and bring them all at the same time back to biblical Zion, and judge the nations while he's doing so, you will be laughed at. It is like an impossible dream to the logical mind. The word laughter is Isaac. Therefore, the birth of Isaac is a prophecy of the birth of Zion. The birth of Zion is likened to laughter. Isaiah 35, verse 2, it says that you will come with joy and singing. Who is this? The ransom of Yahweh will return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy. The state of Zion is born during the tribulation. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. And there appeared a great sign in heaven. One of the ways in which you can say the word sign in Hebrew is Zion. Remember, we're told in the New Testament that the Jews require a sign. That's actually a play on words, because it says the Jews require Zion, which is the meaning of a sign. And if you go to an Orthodox Jew today and say, is Jesus the Messiah? Is Yeshua the Messiah? He'll say, no, why not? Because he didn't gather the exiles of Israel. The gathering of the exiles of Israel is Zion. So their answer of why he's why they say that Yeshua is not the Messiah is because they say we require Zion. We require a sign. So there appeared a great Zion in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. This sign is a woman with a head of crown. What do you do with a head of crown? You rule and reign. With 12 stars, the descendants of Abraham are likened unto stars of the sky. 12 stars, the 12 tribes of Israel. This is the sign to the world and to his people of the end of the exile in the ruling and reign of King Messiah. When this happens, the sun and the moon has got to be under her feet. The sun is a reference to Roman Christianity and the moon, Islam. That this will be the end of Constantine Greco-Roman Christianity when Zion is born, because when Messiah sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives, he's going to be teaching the Torah to all nations from Jerusalem. We will not be celebrating Christmas and Easter during the Messianic era. And Islam will be defeated and will not be an enemy of Zion. Isaiah 66, verse 8 says, for as soon as Zion travailed, the word Zion is the Strong's number 6726, and it tells us here that it's the same as the Strong's number 6725, which is Zion. Zion is mentioned in Jeremiah 31:21. The setting is this. Jeremiah 31, verse 15, Rachel is weeping for her children. And she's told not to weep because your children will come again to their own border. This is specifically referring to the 10 tribes or Ephraim, who is called my dear son. Jeremiah 31, verse 20. Then it says in the King James, set you up waymarks. The word waymarks is the Strong's number 6725. It's the Hebrew word zion, which means a signpost, a monument, or a marker. Now, in the biblical text, there aren't any vowels. Context determines what the word is. Zion and Zion have the same Hebrew letters, a Zadi, a Yod, a Vav, and a Nun. Therefore, whether this word is Zion or Zion in biblical text is context. So you could say, set you up Zion. It's the establishment and the creation of Zion is the sign for Ephraim to return to Zion or to the land of Israel when Rachel, upon that event, will no more be weeping for her children. Micah chapter 5 verse 2 talks about the Messiah being born in Bethlehem, Ephratah, and then it says in Micah chapter 5 verse 3, he will give them up. Giving them up means he's got to hide his face, which means he won't be fully revealed to his people. When is the moment that Messiah is going to begin to fully reveal himself to his people? It's the creation of the state of Zion. He will give them up until the time that she which travails is brought forth. The one that's prevailing is Zion. And then once Zion gives birth, once Zion is created, then the remnant of his brethren shall return to the children of Israel. This is referring to once Zion is born, that begins the ingathering of the exiles. What is biblical Zion again? It's the unification of the people of the God of Israel, Ephraim and Judah, who are standing for the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They want to follow Torah, and they want to be under the leadership of the Messiah. That is biblical Zion, and that will be born as a rebellion from a PLO state. Messiah is glorified through the ingathering of the exiles. Isaiah 35:2. They will see the glory of Yahweh. You know, in traditional Christianity, they're expecting the great glory of Yahweh to come. Well, the glory of Yahweh is the ingathering of the exiles. You will see the glory of Yahweh, and what is it? Isaiah 35:10. The ransom of Yahweh will return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy. We can see how the glory of Yahweh is associated with redeeming his people. Ezekiel 39:21. I will set my glory among the heathen. What is this? Now I will bring again the captivity of Jacob. Messiah will return when the exiles of Israel are gathered. Psalm 102, verse 13 and verse 16. You will arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time has come. When Yahweh, that is Yeshua the Messiah, builds up Zion, that is when he gathers the exiles of Israel, he will appear in his glory. Based upon that foundation, you should be able to understand now Yeshua's prayer in John 17, verse 21, that they all may be one. He's praying that who would be one? The two houses of Israel, Ephraim and Judah. That they may be one, that the world will believe that you sent me. When he gathers his people, he'll be judging the nations, and the world will know that Yeshua is the Messiah and that he is standing for and redeeming Zion. When he redeems his people will be glorified in the earth, and Yeshua will be glorified in the earth. Why? Because they're one. Zion will become a praise in the earth. Yeshua will be glorified. He will set up his kingdom and rule and reign from Jerusalem. That is why we are to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. What is praying for the peace of Jerusalem? It's praying for the end of the exile of the house of Jacob. It's the praying for the coming of King Messiah. It's a prayer for the Messianic era, and it's a prayer for the new heavens and the new earth. I pray that this message has been a blessing to you, and we can see from it that Yeshua's death on the tree, where he stated in John 10, verses 16 and 17, he died to make one sheepfold out of two sheepfolds, which is repeated in John 11, verses 49 through 52, that he died to gather together in one the children of Elohim scattered abroad, that this is completed with the second coming when, through the controversy of Zion and the end time battle between the house of Esau and the house of Jacob, of Israel will be divided. There will be a rebellion against the dividing of the land of Israel, which I believe will, that dividing of the land of Israel is fulfilled through the creation of a PLO state, that there's going to be a rebellion against that by those who want to proclaim the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Messiah will fight for Zion against the nations of the world. He will gather the exiles of Israel, bring them back to the land of Israel, and he will be glorified. Now, the last thing that I want to cover before we close is explaining Revelation 7 and cross-referencing that to Isaiah 49. That's the role of the 144,000. The 144,000 are going to be leading the ingathering of the exiles. In Revelation 14, verse 1, it says, "And looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion with him, 144,000. They're on Mount Zion. Mount Zion is the place where the exiles return to. In verse 2 of Revelation 14, they're playing harps. And in Psalm 137, exile is associated with not playing harps. Psalm 137, verses 1 and 2, "By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down, we wept when we remembered Zion, we hanged our harps upon the willows." Exile is associated with not playing harps. "And they there that carried us away captive required us a song, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion." In Revelation 14, we see the 144,000 on Mount Zion, and they're singing the song of Zion. They're playing their harps. And they sang in Revelation 14, verse 3, a new song. The redemption of the end of days is likened to a new song. Now in Revelation in chapter 7, beginning in verses 9 through 11, it uses tabernacle language. In Leviticus chapter 23, we're told that the reason why we're to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles is to remember the historical Egyptian Exodus. In Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, it says, "After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people." Tabernacles is called the Feast of All Nations. And then it says they had palms in their hands. It's at Tabernacles where you have the waving of palms. Then in verse 10 it says, "They cried with a loud voice, salvation to our God." And it was at Tabernacles where there was a ceremony in the temple where they shouted, "Hosanna, save us! Hosanna, save us!" So this is tabernacle talk telling you that the 144,000 are leading in Exodus back to the land of Israel, and it's likened to the tabernacles of old. In Revelation chapter 12, with the great sign that appeared, From the time of that sign, we are told that there is 1,260 days. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 14, "And the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, unto her place where she is nourished for a time, time, and half a time, from the face of the serpent." Now, historically, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, they went into the wilderness. And we're told in Exodus in chapter 19 and verse 3, we're told that when they came out, it says, "You have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself." In Revelation chapter 12, those who are going into the wilderness, in verse 14, are given two wings of a great eagle. It's using the same terminology and talk of the historical Egyptian redemption. Now in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 13, a question is asked by one of the elders. "Who are these which are arrayed in white robes, and where did they come?" And he said, "Sir, you know, these are they which came out of the great tribulation, which is the last 3.5 years. And in order to identify who these are who came out of the great tribulation, who are being led by the 144,000, here's how they're described. Verses 16 and 17, "They will hunger no more, neither thirst no more, neither shall the sunlight of them, nor any heat, for the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and he will lead them unto living fountains of water." Those who came out of great tribulation will hunger no more, they'll thirst no more, neither shall the sunlight on them, nor any heat, for the Lamb, that is Yeshua the Messiah, will feed them upon fountains of living water. We can understand that this refers to the exiles of Israel by cross-referencing these verses to Isaiah chapter 49. The context of Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6, is the gathering of the exiles of Israel. It's a light thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. And speaking about the ingathering of the exiles, it says in Isaiah 49:9 that you may say to the prisoners, go forth. To those in darkness, those who are not following Torah, show yourselves, start following Torah. The prisoners are the exiles of Israel. And speaking about the prisoners or the exiles of Israel, here's what it says about them in Isaiah 49:10. And this is what's quoted in Revelation chapter 7, verse 16. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. For he that has mercy on them, who we're told in Revelation 7 is the Lamb, the Messiah, shall lead them, even by springs of water shall he guide them. So we're told in Revelation chapter 12 that Zion will be born during the tribulation, and from the birth of Zion to the coming of Messiah is 3.5 years. Revelation 7, we're told that's the 144,000 who's leading the exiles of Israel, and the ones who are leading have come out of great tribulation, and the terminology it's said of them that's coming out of great tribulation is the same terminology in Isaiah 49 that speaks about the exiles of Israel being redeemed. So the period of time given for the exiles of Israel to be gathered is the final 3.5 years, commonly called the Great Tribulation. And that process begins after there's a creation of PLO state, a rebellion against that PLO state, and against the decree of one world government to obey the rules and the laws of one world government, which is a parallel to what Antiochus IV decreed, that everyone would obey Greek culture, that to rebel against that decree was subject to death. Those who stand for the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to stand for biblical Zion and who rebel, they will have a death sentence upon them. But the Messiah will come, and he will fight against those nations that fight against Zion, and he will defeat the enemies of Zion in such a way that the world will recognize and acknowledge that the miracles of redemption that's being performed for Zion is only a miracle that the God of Israel can do, even like ultimately it was acknowledged in Egypt that it was Yahweh who performed these miracles. And through it, Yeshua the Messiah will be glorified. He will set his feet down on the Mount of Olives, and he will set up his kingdom, and those of Zion redeemed will rule and reign with him. I pray this message has been a blessing to you. Remember always these words from 1 John chapter 2 and verse 6. He who says he abides in him, he who says he's a believer in Yeshua as the Messiah, ought himself to walk, that is to live our lives, even as he walked. And how did Yeshua walk or live his life? He followed Torah. Even so, he said to us in John 14, verse 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.